Guardian Unlimited.
Over 10 novels, as well as short stories and non-fiction, Peter Carey has established himself as Australia's most celebrated writer, with subjects ranging from the underside of Dickens's Great Expectations, the unwritten life of Pip's benefactor Magwitch in Jack Mags in the 19th century, to a future dystopia in The Unusual Life of Tristram Smith. His novels have made him one of only two authors ever to win two Booker Prizes. Running through these books in characteristically picaresque tales of luminous eccentrics is a preoccupation with Australian identity, which continues in his latest novel, His Illegal Self, which follows a young American boy abandoned by his student radical parents on an unlikely journey to the unforgiving terrain of Queensland with a woman he thinks is his mother. Peter Carey began by giving us a flavour of the new book by reading from the first chapter.
By now they were out on Lexington Avenue and his grandma was looking for a taxi. The first cab would be theirs, always was, except that now his hand was inside his true mother's hand and they were marsupials running down into the subway, laughing. In Bloomingdale's, everything had been so white and bright with glistening brass. Now they raced down the steps. He could have flown. At the turnstile, she released his hand and pushed him under. She slipped off her pack. He was giddy, giggling. She was laughing too. They had entered another planet, and as they pushed down to the platform, the ceiling was slimed with alien rust and the floor was flecked and speckled with black gum. So this was the real world that had been crying to him from beneath the grating up on Lex. They ran together to the local, and his heart was pounding and his stomach was filled with bubbles like an ice cream float. She took his hand once more and kissed it, stumbling. The 6 train carried him through the dark, wire skeins unravelling, his entire life changing all at once. He burped again. The cars swayed and screeched, thick teams of brutal cable showing in the windowed dark. And then he was in Grand Central, first time ever, and they set off underground, again hand in hand, slippery together as newborn goats. Men lived in cardboard boxes. A blind boy rattled dimes and quarters in a tin. The S train waited, painted like a warrior, and they jumped together and the doors closed as cruel as traps, chop, 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 and his face was pushed against his mother's jasmine dress. Her hand held the back of his head. He was underground, as Cameron in 5D had predicted. They will come for you, man. They'll break you out of here.
I was just wondering, you must be relatively giddy from the amount of publicity you're doing for this book. It sounds like you've been very busy in London. And I did gather from your press officer that one of the things you've done is Desert Island Discs. Are you aware of what a high honour in this country that is?
I do happen to live with a very fine Englishwoman who said, "Oh my God, Desert Island Discs." Her mother lives in Beckles, which is near Southville. Oh, so yeah, she's on the phone to her mother saying, "Peter's on Desert Island Discs," and the mother's going, "That's fantastic." So I was aware in that way of what Desert Island Discs.
Effectively a knight of the realm now.
It's a pretty lowbrow list, I have to tell you.
I was wondering whether it's kind of surprising for somebody who's focused on marginal figures and a country that feels itself quite marginal to find yourself placed so slap bang in the middle of the mainstream establishment, you might almost call it. Yeah. Because you did also have an audience with the Queen at some point, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I did, absolutely. We had some scheduling conflict, and finally finally we got together. I was in Jamaica at some literary thing, and I won the prize. In fact, that was what the literary thing was, Commonwealth Prize. And they said, "Well, now you're going to meet the Queen." And I said, "What?" And then I got very nervous, not about personally meeting the Queen, but you know, I am a Republican, and I certainly didn't want the monarchist present in Australia to be sort of
think that you'd join their side or whatever.
But, you know, in the end, I thought, well, if Nixon can meet Mao Zedong, I guess I can say hello to the Queen. And I did also think, and said, you know, if anybody is oppressing the Australian people, it's the Australian people. If they had the sense and good judgment to decide that they would be a republic, they would be. And I doubt that Her Majesty would send a gunboat. And so, you know, it's our fault, not hers, I do believe.
It doesn't indicate to you that their culture has sort of changed a bit when, for an Australian writer to find himself carrying multiple laurels, Booker Prizes, and now...
Yeah, it has changed an awful lot. I mean, I think I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it anymore. And it's very pleasant of you to have raised the issue at this particular time. Thank you very much. At the time when I was first beginning to write, I think I would have thought it was impossible to be published in this country. And I think, and a little later, you would have thought that, you know, the fact that there even was an Australian literature would have been a remarkable thought. You know, we would be a little bit like, you know, dogs standing on their hind legs and walking, a little bit. You know, I'm talking about the 60s and late 50s. So, yes, things have changed a great deal. And certainly that sort of rather patronizing attitude towards Australia, which one expected in the 50s and 60s, seems to have disappeared from many aspects of British life, including literature. I mean, sometimes I thought that I've seen aspects of it in theatre reviews, for instance, but not in literature. And yes, it is a big change, but many other things have changed as well.
Mm. And talking of lost and changed worlds, your current novel, His Illegal Self, is set in the world of the late 60s and early 70s, mm-hmm. political extremism, mm-hmm. radical sort of anti-Vietnam extremism in both Australia and America. I wondered what led you there.
Nothing particularly sensible or current. Here, the real truth of it is that in the previous book, Theft to Love Story, I had really enjoyed inhabiting a part of the Australia where I'd lived, on a river called the Never Never. And I was staggered to discover I hadn't lived there for a long time, that I had all this stuff in my head, that I could evoke the physical place in all sorts of ways I didn't think, and I enjoyed it. You know, I'm living in New York, so you know, in my head I was on the Never Never, you know, for weeks and months. And I think one of the things that drew me to this particular novel was place, and I had lived in what we then called an alternative community, and the locals called...
Because it's an environment you knew, the early 70s, where you...
Yeah, it was about the mid-70s by then. Everybody's, you know, what were they called, sort of crushed velvet things, and it all worn out, and everyone was wearing Kmart shirts and things like that. But yes, middle 70s. And firstly, I love the notion of writing about that place, because I always felt so privileged to be there, and I really loved my time there, you know, apart from the Queensland police who harassed us to death and so on. And there was also a story that I'd been carrying from that time, which was a guy who... It was a lovely place to live because no one ever asked you, for many reasons, but no one would ever say, what do you do? It was sort of a stupid question, and no one ever asked it. And so people turned up. They were just there. And this American guy turned up. I think he was from Texas, but I'm not sure. And everyone was pleased he was there, and he bought this neglected hut, or shack, or house, whatever you want to call it. And we were pleased that was being fixed up, and then we noticed he was planting marijuana plants on his front driveway. We said, no, you're not where you think you are. You are not at the
not
end of at the end of the
as
earth.
Free and easy no. as you imagined.
And then there was a huge police raid with helicopters and blah, 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 blah. And we discovered he'd been wanted for a conspiracy to import cocaine into the United States from Mexico. And then various comic things began to happen, like us driving around with jam jars full of 20-cent pieces, trying to ring a lawyer in Texas but from a public phone in the mountains at the back of blah, blah. So I didn't want to write about him, and I wasn't interested in drug dealers, so I went looking for another reason why someone might be on the run during that sort of time. At another period in my life, I'd been involved in the anti-war movement, so I knew what Che, the boy in my story, would call... I knew all the fractions.
As he called them.
Yes.
Did you find yourself wondering, as you were writing about it, about the differences between the sort of world of radical American politics and in Australia, the sort of different inflections?
Yes. I mean, I think that one of the things that I discovered as I started... I mean, I had friends who were at Harvard during the heady days of SDS, and, you know, who knew people who were in the Weather Underground. And so I talked quite a lot just over the years with these friends about that time. But the thing that really struck me as I began to research it and think about it some more is how, of course, from Australia, you don't really think about how privileged they were. You know, the minute to be in Harvard, I mean, is sort of, you know, you drop dead top of the tree. There was not an awful lot of scholarships there. I mean, for me to put a female character there, which I did, was rather remarkable. So the people that were there were really, really privileged. And so I started to think about, and very different from the radicals I'd known in Australia, who tended to be more based in, you know, or connected with at least trade union movements and or have alliances with them and have not all be sort of dope-smoking hippies, although many of them were dope-smoking hippies, but they were more politically connected and had more of an idea of some sort of grassroots organization, where the Harvard people... Really, it seemed to me that they decided they were going to have a revolution. They didn't actually get too much outside of Harvard Yard or anybody who was not you know, like them. And when they couldn't get their revolution, they decided to start blowing things up. This seemed like sort of petulance to me, and that was sort of interesting.
It is odd how much more sort of explosively violent they are, although they're contending, the Australians are contending with, in some ways, worse things. They have the draft, and in Queensland, where you set this book, they also have a much more repressive environment than the weathermen thought they were living in.
Well, I don't know exactly what environment. We do forget that the 60s was, in many respects, a very, very scary place. And so I don't know what sort of police harassment and spies and things were going on there. But I know in Australia, living with the Queensland police force, they were really, really corrupt. They were nasty, and the government was nasty. One of the weird things about living in Queensland, in this idyllic place, I can remember many times driving south to Sydney and just getting over the border and feeling a huge weight lift off you. Almost my first morning in Queensland, I was beginning to repair this hut. These two policemen turned up, and one of them said, what's your name? And I said, it's Peter Carey. And they said, all right, Peter. All right, Peter. And then they said, what's your place and date of birth? No one would ask anyone to produce a driver's license or anything in those years. My voice doubtless rose, you know, three octaves. And I said, yeah, why do you want to know that? I don't think I have to tell you that. And they said, listen, Peter, you're in Queensland now, and we don't need a warrant to search this place, and we'll find something. Don't you worry. So that was my sort of introduction, and it was way worse than that.
And it didn't actually send you off to make bombs or any of your comrades?
No, actually, but there was an appalling, brutal, corrupt sort of drug squad guy who was always harassing hippies. And this kid did set a bomb for this guy and called him. Not in where we lived, not in the community, but on the coast, because it was close to the coast. This fella, he was a cunning old cop. So when he got the call, he just waited outside the house. He didn't go in. And some other poor kid went inside the house and got blown up. So things like that were going on. The road to Trevor Dobbs's hideout was like he had bragged to the boy already. Outlaw, very steep, rutted, washed away, potholes, tank traps, killer rocks, one stained black with oil, the death of an auto owned by someone who had no business. It was on a road that didn't want you any more than you wanted it. On the high side of the cutting, there was wild bush, but no shade at that hour, and the dirt was baked hard and comfortless. There were no threats or skulls or crossbones nailed to tree trunks. But at one place there was an abandoned Volvo in a tree. It seemed to have slid down the tree and then skidded backwards into space. And there it had come to a stop with its back wheel stuck in a burned-out wattle. The front wheels had slipped clear off the edge of the road and it clung to the yellow clay road with just inches to spare. Beneath it was nothing but giddiness. The Volvo had gotten burned at the time of the accident or later, you couldn't tell. It was black from fire and brown from rust and thin as cigarette paper, like an eaten wasp abandoned in a web. As the boy and the mother approached, they heard a rustling sound in its dark throat. Then, loud flapping or slapping. The boy's hair was too heavy to stand upright, but it pulled at his scalp and filled his neck with fright. Then a huge black bird, a vulture, he thought, but a turkey, actually, flew out the front window, leaving the shell of rust to rock and sway like a dead flower on a brittle black stem. The boy's heart was in his ears. His legs were aching. He asked, how will he know where to find me? Who, baby? She said. My daddy, he said, his throat stinging. Dial squatted down before him, her two big eyes watching him as though he were a mouse in a glue trap, something she did not know how to kill. Have you been thinking about your daddy? What did she think, he thought, forever through the sweaty nights and burning days. Oh, baby, she said, and reached out to hug him.
This is a question that you must get asked an awful lot, but it is surprising for a writer so preoccupied with Australia that you've been living in America for 15 years. Does it surprise you to find that that's where your imagination is always leading you back?
No, I'm more pleased that I'm able to do it. I really did not go to the United States for my own career or even primarily in my own desire to be in America. I went because I was living with somebody who was excited about that. And I thought, well, not a bad idea. But I also thought, because I was continually anxious that I was living in the wrong place for who I am. You know, that I write about Australia. It's what I've always done. It's what I'm preoccupied with. And indeed, the first book that I began in the United States, The Unusual Life of Tristan Smith, two imaginary countries. And I think it was my way of trying to deal with the situation that I found myself in and to reflect on the quite sometimes brutal relationship between the United States and Australia. In the end, I just realized I could write The Kelly Gang in New York, and that was sort of thrilling. And I thought, my American friends were always saying, when are you going to write about us? And I felt sort of that I should, but then I decided I could never do it. But this book, I was sort of led there. I've explained the idea. The idea is based on the notion that there's an American who turns up in this alternative community in Queensland in the 70s. So I've got to imagine an American character, one at least, the boy, because I think it's a hippie mother and a child at first. And then finally, I've got two American characters. And because I was so much in the middle of their characters, and I knew the places, I was not really worrying about whether I could get them right or couldn't get them right because I was in the middle of telling a story. And finally, I've written two American characters, and I'm sort of thrilled. I wrote a book set in Malaysia, and I gave the book to Malaysian writers before I published, anxious that I should respect and they should be right, And this book I gave to my American writer friends. No one told me I got anything wrong, and I was looking for that.
Right.
So I was very pleased.
I suppose, one of the things that draws you back to Australia, as well as the fascination with the culture, also seems to be, and I suppose it's bound up, is the terrain of Australia itself. You're fascinated with the land.
When you ask Australians who live abroad what it is that they miss, the first thing they tend to say, they don't say, all my friends. They tend to say the land. And growing up in Australia, you do grow up closer. Even people being born in cities now, with closer to the idea of the land and the land than you would say growing up in New York City. New Yorkers often get very strange when they get into the woods and not know quite what to do. So I think we are really, really like that. And that's why I believe that when one's talking about Australians' relationship with the Aboriginal people, I think even the most conservative, even the most racist of Australians would at the bottom of their heart know that it is the Aboriginal people's land and that they know more about the land than any of us. This is a land that really kills white people, essentially.
Yes, it did.
And they for 50,000 years, knew how to live and have a rich culture there. We're really aware, I think, of that. Even the worst of us are aware of that. And even people who might never have met an Aboriginal person, I think this issue is always there because we do love that land.
Yeah, and you've written about the Aboriginal, deeper Aboriginal history in a non-fiction book, in the book about Sydney. But I have wondered why Aboriginal characters haven't really found their way into your novels.
Well, there's all sorts of reasons. Certainly the notion, like Oscar and Lucinda is really built around the notion of the Christian stories coming, floating in a box through a landscape of Aboriginal stories. Mm. And the Aboriginal stories will be destroyed and the Christian stories will flourish for a little while. So it grows out of that concern. And it's me, and I'm writing about that from something that I can know. Illiwacka, is something all about lies. The fundamental lie is that the land was not being used and therefore could be taken. There's a doctrine of terra nullius, which Australia has sort of built this crap thing. So these notions have always concerned me, but I've also been really aware that there's Aboriginal people do not need me to represent their culture. I feel free enough to acknowledge what the situation, our historical situation is. I sort of have a feeling that I'd be better not meddling with that too much. I think as an issue, it's a really, really important one. And that goes so against all the other things I would normally say. Here's why I would say, this is a contradiction here, because I would say on the one hand, I'm a writer, what my job is to know what it is, to imagine what it is to be other. Yeah, I can write about a woman, I can write about, a child, I don't have to be that person in any way at all. But yet, when it comes to this particular issue, which is probably the single most important thing in my country's life, I think I should stay away from imagining Aboriginal people because I think it's been done sort of rather badly, sort of too often, and I'd be better off not meddling with it.
Right. Okay.
Now, it's a sort of cowardice in a way, and maybe I'll change my mind about it because it certainly is something I think about a lot.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to Guardian Unlimited, Peter Carey.
Thank you.
Guardian Unlimited.